This is Intercom Feedback Loop. I am your host, Chase Hendrickson, and welcome you to this Journal Club podcast series brought to you by Endocrine Society. Thanks for joining us as we explore an important article recently published in one of the Society's clinical journals. Welcome again to Endocrine Feedback Loop for our 21st episode. For today's podcast, we review a clinical trial in the JCENM that looks at some of the metabolic changes associated with a dual GIP and GLP-1 receptor agonist compared to just a GLP-1 receptor agonist in placebo. Most of the studies we review here are observational investigations, so this article gives us the opportunity to see how clinical trials differ in their methodology, in addition to learning about a medication that may be available to us in the future. As a reminder, I host the Endocrine Feedback Loop podcast. I work at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee, where I am a general endocrinologist, the medical director for our outpatient clinics, and an associate director for our fellowship program. Two excellent diabetologists join me today in our virtual recording studio. Returning as our regular contributors, none other than Ashok Balasubramanian, coming to us from Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, Texas. He holds numerous positions there, including as full professor, vice president, and senior associate dean of their medical school, as well as directing their clinical scientist training program. He may be best known to most of you all in his role as the chair of the endocrinology specialty board for the ABIM. Our guest expert today comes to us from the United Kingdom and from the University of Swansea in Wales. Steve Bain is the clinical director of the Diabetes Research Center there, where he holds a chair in medicine and diabetes. His research started in the genetics of type 1 diabetes, but now encompasses many aspects of diabetes. So as you can tell, we've got a great group to look at this article today. As usual, everything we say will be our opinions only and not those of the Endocrine Society or of our respective institutions. For this episode, we look at effects of tirzepatide, a dual GIP and GLP-1 receptor agonist, on lipid and metabolic profiles in subjects with type 2 diabetes. The Journal of Clinical Endocrinology Metabolism will publish this article soon, with it currently being available in advance form, with Valentina Pirro serving as the first author. Ashok, please walk us through the introduction of this article and highlight, along with Steve, some of the key clinical and research aspects we need to be considering here.
Sure, happy to do that, Chase. So this article really caught my eye, mainly because of the tremendous interest in recent years in incretin-based therapy. We all know that these have become, in certain circumstances, frontline treatment. And there's a whole range of different glucagon-like peptide 1 agonists that are available for clinical treatment. And we know that they have multiple benefits related to not only glycemic control, but also weight loss, and very crucially, in terms of cardiovascular and renal outcomes. All of these improve with the use of these agents. Now, there is another incretin that has generally been in the shadows, which is GIP, which is glucose-dependent insulinotropic polypeptide, rather a mouthful, which is called a GIP. And there have been certainly a number of trials which have combined agonists of both GLP-1 and GIP to see if you get an additional effect from combining these two different incretins. So I guess the first question would be whether or not the standard of care should include, you know, treatment with both of these incretins. And hopefully, you know, the results of the study will help us understand the potential benefits of doing this. Now, the drug they've chosen to study in particular is something called tirzepatide, which is a dual agonist of both the GIP receptor and the GLP-1 receptor. There are some differences in terms of the affinity of these agents for their receptors compared to the native hormones. But I think that the real important thing is what is the biochemical and clinical outcome, which we'll discuss in a few minutes. So the preliminary studies that led up to this suggested that tirzepatide potentially has enhanced weight loss effects and also excellent insulin sensitizing effects, maybe independent of weight loss, suggesting that its mode of action might be a little bit different from that of the GLP-1 agonists. And to try to dissect these differences and also to look at the overall metabolic impact, what these investigators have done is to use the science of metabolomics, which would be a quantitative analysis of large numbers of metabolites that are circulating, and to discern from their patterns whether we have any beneficial effects or deleterious effects and how they impinge on complex metabolic pathways that end up giving us the final clinical effects. The other reason for doing the study in a way that involves metabolomics is to see if any of these patterns throw up novel biomarkers. patients that might be used to either subclassify types of diabetes or subclassify patients who might benefit from one or another kind of intervention for diabetes, and also just to be able to define the disease better. And the metabolomic clusters that have been known in previous studies to associate with insulin resistance or type 2 diabetes include, in particular, the branch chain amino acids and their catabolites, also triglycerides of various different compositions, and finally, two molecules, 2-hydroxybutyric acid, or 2-HB, and 2-ketobutyric acid, or 2-KB, which are of particular importance in considering biomarkers of insulin resistance. So I'll stop at this point and ask Dr. Bain if he would like to add any points or to review particularly the importance of these pathways to metabolism and to clinical practice.
I think one of the important questions at the moment is that with the dual agonists such as tirzepatide, what exactly the GIP bit is doing. And I think there are a number of cynics out there who query whether the GIP is simply allowing one to use higher doses of GLP-1 receptor agonists because of the impact of the GIP on reducing the adverse events, which namely are GI side effects and around nausea and vomiting. And I've certainly heard lots of colleagues suggest that if you were able to increase the dosing of currently available GLP-1 receptor agonists, especially semaglutide and dulaglutide, which are the sort of most commonly initiated GLP-1 receptor agonists now, whether you'd see exactly the same difference. So the importance, I think, in this study is whether there are specific differences in the impact on these metabolic markers that have been assessed that begin to show a split between GLP-1 receptor agonists as we have them, and noting that both dulaglutide and semaglutide are now going to be available in higher doses versus this dual agonism. And so that's what I think is important about this paper. In terms of the actual metabolic markers, I think going back to my genetics background, people used to look at candidate genes and then random genetic markers in genome-wide analyses. And the question's always been whether these are really fundamental metabolic things that make a difference, or whether they're just accidental markers that are being highlighted by the studies. So with the three that you mentioned, the branch chain amino acids, the triglycerides and diglycerides, and then the 2-HD and 2-KB, it does appear that there's some proper background to these in that they've not only been isolated, but they've been replicated. And replication, I think, is an absolutely crucial thing. And once they've been replicated and found to be apparently important in different populations, then can you come up with a metabolic rationale for why they may be influencing insulin resistance and glucose tolerance? So I think it's an important study. I think it's an important area. And for me, this paper does begin to suggest that the GIP bit of the dual agonist is actually giving an enhanced benefit versus just giving a higher dose of GLP-1 receptor agonist.
And before we move into the methodology, I thought I would circle back to something that Ashok pointed out already, and that's that when the authors describe particularly GLP-1 receptor agonist, and then that'll be one of the comparisons that they use here, they do describe it as a standard of care for diabetes, and actually a bit more specifically as the standard of care for diabetes. So I thought before we moved on and look at this paper, we'd think a little bit more about the context this is in and really try to wrestle with that, because I think that has a lot of implications as describing a specific therapy among the many that we have available in type 2 diabetes as the standard of care. And so I thought maybe Steve and Ashok, you two are experienced diabetologists, you take care of a lot of patients. How do you think about this class of medications and specifically the ones that we have available, these GLP-1 receptor agonists? Do you consider that to be the standard of care or maybe one of many options, though the one with some unique benefits among the different medications that we have available? Steve, maybe we'll start with you.
I think there's no doubt that SGLT2 inhibitors and GLP-1 receptor agonists have both moved up the algorithm. And in the ADA, ESD, algorithm for glucose lowering, both of these classes are now considered as an option as second line after metformin in patients for whom glucose control is not achieved, and especially in the setting of comorbidities such as cardiovascular disease, chronic kidney disease, and chronic heart failure. So I think in that setting, if cost has no impact, then these would be seen as second line. And then moving down the algorithm in those who don't have those comorbidities, you're looking at consideration of weight, you're looking at consideration of hypoglycemia, and then at the far end of the algorithm, cost begins to come in. The cardiologists, certainly in Europe, have moved that a step further. They've argued that these are both classes of drugs that have got evidence-based benefits. And so why would you use metformin first? Because the evidence supporting metformin outside glucose lowering is certainly tenuous. It comes from a very small subset of the United Kingdom prospective diabetes study from many years ago. So that, allied with the fact that we have such treatment inertia in diabetes and we don't escalate treatments quickly, why wouldn't you go straight to these treatments with cardiovascular benefit? Having said that, in places like the UK where I practice, and I think many parts of Europe, the use of GLP-1 receptor agonists and the use of SGLT2 inhibitors is far lower than it should be if you took into consideration the inclusion criteria for those cardiovascular outcome trials. And now we have heart failure trials and renal trials. So I think their cost and the fact that people are just slow to take on new therapies, it remains an issue. So it may be a viewpoint that this is the standard of care, but in real life, this is not what's happening. I know in the UK, 30% of second-line therapy is sulfonylureas, which are, you know, in the key opinion leaders, are largely discredited sort of agents. So yes, on one hand, they're sort of right in that maybe this should be the standard of care, but on the other hand, it certainly isn't.
Ashok, maybe why don't you give us your perspective on that and potentially your impression from a US perspective on it. Would this be considered the standard of care, or is perhaps that an overstatement of how we view things in diabetes care?
Well, I think Steve really laid it out beautifully, beginning with the fact that I totally agree with him that the ADA/EASD consensus opinion is extremely enlightened. And I think that it's based on lots of really great trials. And then moving these agents, the two classes he mentioned, which includes the incretins, up to immediately following metformin, or in the practice of some, including cardiologists, maybe with metformin or even without metformin, I think has a lot to recommend it. And the consensus statement lays it out very beautifully. And the issue also, as Steve mentioned, is its practicability given economics, given medical systems. And as everyone knows, the medical delivery system in the US is much more chaotic and fractured than it is in the United Kingdom and perhaps in other parts of Europe. So I myself practice in a medical center where we see patients both in the county indigent hospital system as well as in the private practice. And I hate to say this, but there is a division in what's available in these two places. So the consensus and the algorithms are one thing. What you're actually able to do is quite another thing. But I must say that the scientific rationale is excellent, but you have to account for the cost and you have to account for, you know, what the insurance system will allow. But I would agree that there's a rationale for making it definitely a second-line standard of care for diabetes, for sure.
Good. Thanks. Thank you both there. I think that's helpful to outline why we want to understand these medications and advancements here as we look forward to future developments. So as we move into the methodology here, we're going to first do what we normally do and take just a step back and think about methodology overall, what it is, how it is that this investigation is structured so that when we look at the details of it, we can put it in its proper perspective. So first of all, just a really quick highlight on randomized control trials, how those work. And I think what's most helpful to think about those is we contrast them to observational trials. As I mentioned in the introduction, we tend to look mostly at observational trials, but this one is not. And so the reason that RCTs are considered the gold standard in understanding, particularly if an intervention is effective or not, is how RCTs are designed to deal with both bias and confounding. And those are the two issues that all observational studies, by their very nature, have as a weakness. So bias, as a reminder of that, a bias is when one group is treated differently from another group, to put it simply. And this happens all the time in observational studies and is very difficult to deal with in many situations. And the reason that randomized control trials are so effective at that is because they are blinded. We're going to look at how this study does that here shortly. But if you don't know which group either you as a subject are in, or as you as an investigator, you don't know which groups of subjects that you are looking at are in, that is incredibly effective because you can't treat folks differently if you don't know which group that they're in. So that is how RCTs are so effective at dealing with bias. And then the second issue, confounding, is that whenever you have identified an exposure that you're hoping to identify if that drives an outcome or not, confounding is when there is an associated factor. It's associated to that exposure that is really the driver of the outcome, and that you have misunderstood or mislabeled what it is that's causing that outcome. And the reason that RCTs are able to deal with confounding so effectively is not that they get rid of it, but if you randomize, if you have a large enough number of subjects and you randomize effectively, then you have evenly distributed those confounders in your two or however many groups that you have. So it's, again, not that they go away, but that they essentially balance each other out, that they cancel each other out in the analysis. And so you don't have to worry about the effect skewing your understanding of that relationship between exposure and outcome. Then we're going to look at how this works out, but those are the strengths of an RCT and why it's considered the gold standard in these and the types of investigations. So second of all, what we're going to do is look at phases of drug trials. There are different ways of describing phases of drug trials, and there are some disagreements on exactly how you would define those. So we're going to look at just one way of describing them at a very high level, but that will help us understand where this study fits in as far as the investigation and the development of a new drug. So first of all, when we talk about these, sometimes you'll hear about preclinical trials being mentioned, and those are in vitro studies. Those are animal studies. That's in the very earliest stages of drug development. And then as you actually move into these agents being investigated in humans, there are different places where you can start that process, but I'd say fairly commonly is a phase one study. And in a phase one study, the focus there is on safety. That tends to be very, very small numbers of individuals, sometimes healthy individuals, sometimes folks with disease. And the idea there is to study toxicity, to try to begin to understand appropriate dosing of a medication. That then moves on to phase two, which we'll come to shortly, but it's what this study is. And phase two is where you really begin to wrestle with the idea of effectiveness. How effective is this agent at treating whatever we hope that it's going to work against? Again, relatively small numbers, usually in the hundreds, sometimes often less than 100. And again, they're mostly looking at efficacy, still with an eye towards side effects, that as you add numbers of subjects, you can begin to get a better sense of that. Phase three trials, I'd say, are the ones that we're most familiar with. Those are the ones that are truly designed to prove the effectiveness of an agent. Depending upon the disease that you're looking at and how frequently that occurs and the effectiveness of the agent, it's very large numbers, hundreds, thousands, sometimes tens of thousands of individuals are in these studies to prove them. And they are often compared to other agents, if there's an established standard of care. Sometimes there's a placebo if there's not. And this begins to look at long-term safety data. And to wrap up some of this terminology, there are phase four studies, and those are studies that come out after a drug has been approved. And once it's been approved, there is ongoing analysis, sometimes the safety data, sometimes worrisome side effects aren't readily apparent until a drug has been out and been in use by many, many people for many, many years. And so that's ongoing safety monitoring is at phase four when we talk about that. So to go back to this study, this is a double-blind, placebo-controlled phase 2B clinical trial. And they had 316 participants who were assigned to 26 weeks of treatment, and there were several different groups here. So the first group that we're going to look at is groups that had were assigned different doses of the investigational agent, this tirzepatide. So it was a weekly subcutaneous injection. One group received 1 milligram, 1 5 milligrams, 1 10 milligrams, and 1 15 milligrams. So actually four groups that received the tirzepatide at varying doses. There was another group, the active comparison group was dulaglutide, and that was 1.5 milligrams weekly that was received. And then the final group was a placebo group. group. And the study procedure for this aspect of it was to understand lab changes. So we'll talk about what those are here in just a second. But the procedure for that was that there were fasting lab draws, and those were done at baseline, so before anything was started. And then after things were started at the 4-week point, the 12-week point, and then the 26-week point. And with those, there was extensive testing. So two large categories of tests that were run. One was targeted metabolomics, and they had enough sample to run that on 259 of the subjects. And then there were also shotgun lipidomics, and there were 252 subjects in this larger group of 316 that had enough to be able to run that on. So in a second here, Ashok's going to walk us through a lot of these numbers. He's mentioned some in the introduction already that we're focused on, but there are a lot, to put it mildly, of data that's looked at here, a lot of specific lab values. So Steve, we thought here we'd pause and go back to you. You've given us a little bit of an overview about how we're supposed to look at this when we see lots of information come out, but help us think about this. So Ashok's going to walk us through a bunch of these numbers here in a second. What should we be looking for? How do we, who are often clinical diabetologists or endocrinologists or maybe even primary care providers, not used to dealing with these, not really sure what we're looking for. Maybe some of these terms we're familiar with, but by and large, we're not familiar with these. How should we be evaluating this to try to understand the impact of this new medication?
Chase, I think the first thing to say is that this paper, all 16 pages of it, is a heavy read. And for people in primary care and specialist care, I think it's something that you need to set aside quite a long time to look at. In terms of the markers, these metabolites they've been looking at, they've split them into targeted metabolites and shotgun lipidomics, they call them. And if I refer back to my genetics background, I would regard this as very similar to what we used to have as candidate gene studies and genome-wide studies. Now, candidate gene studies was where you were looking for the genetics of a complex disease, for example, using genetic markers that you thought might actually be part of the disease process. So you're using things that there was a rationale for saying, well, this gene may well be involved in the etiology of type 1 or type 2 diabetes, and so we'll examine it in a population of people who've got the condition and those who haven't. And I think this is sort of similar to looking at these branched chain amino acids, triglycerides, diglycerides, whatever, that Ashok was talking about earlier, where these have been demonstrated, at least in a preliminary form, to be involved in insulin resistance, in glucose abnormalities. And so there's a rationale for why these may be useful to look at. The sort of shotgun thing is where, still sticking to the lipid area, you're looking at any lipid metabolite that you can measure and saying, well, there's no particular rationale for why this might be something that would be targeted by tirzepatide versus dulaglutide versus nothing, but let's look at them anyway. So that's much more a sort of fishing expedition, I guess, where it may be involved and it may not. And if you do find a positive association or a negative association in that setting, it certainly doesn't prove anything, but it will be something that could then be examined in future studies. I think from this study, as we'll hear from Ashok and yourself later on, the fact that the targeted areas that had got some sort of background saying, these lipid markers may be important, the fact that the study seemed to support that, I think, is a strength of the study and gives a further rationale for additional studies going forward. So I hope that's a sort of useful way of trying to explain.
Yes, absolutely. So that'll help us when Ashok walks us through these numbers, what we're looking for here. And then, yes, as we get to the discussion after that, the authors attempt to make some connections there between those mechanisms that you're discussing and how I can connect these outcomes that we're looking for here. Okay, good. So just a final word on the statistics. The authors here use a modified intent to treat analysis. And of note, where they modified this is, so they included only patients with baseline data. So I mentioned earlier that they didn't have enough sample for all of these patients to be included here. So they included only those with baseline data. But then they also included only those who didn't have any issue with drug discontinuation or had to have rescue drug initiation. And so I'll mention as a side here, and if Steve and Ashok have anything to mention, we're certainly welcome there. input as well. But normally in a phase three trial, this is not something that you would want to have happen. So in a phase three trial, you would want to analyze people only as they were randomized, whatever group that they were put in here. And even if it was somebody who was assigned to take an investigational drug and then stopped taking the investigational drug. Phase two is not quite as strict because, again, you're really trying to understand different aspects of exactly how does this drug work? What kind of doses do we need of this medication for it to be effective? You're trying to understand the way that it works a bit more. And so you need to be able to use an analysis that lets you see when the subjects are actually taking the medication as has been prescribed, what outcomes do you see? And then you leave it to phase three trials to have the true intention to treat analysis. And finally on here, the authors use a mixed model, repeated measures for several different factors. So the baseline hemoglobin A1C, the BMI, metformin use as well. So those were all as covariates. And then they also looked at treatment and time and treatment by time interaction. And then finally, they did a linear regression analysis, and that was used to estimate the variability of the metabolite and lipid changes by weight loss. So what the authors are hoping to prove here, and was mentioned already in the introduction, is how much of the benefit of these medications is driven by the weight loss that you see and how much of it appears to be independent of weight loss. So that's why they do this regression analysis, and Ashok will walk us through those results here shortly. So with that, I'm going to turn it back over to him so he can start taking on the difficult task of walking us through all these complicated numbers.
Thanks, Chase, and thanks, Steve, for setting this up. I wanted to just expand briefly on a point that Steve made before I get into the results, which is, since this is a follow-up of their original trial, just to look at the basic outcome of glucose lowering, they were tagging on these metabolite measurements, it's important to sort of have in mind what would be a good outcome versus what would be a bad outcome, because there are so many things measured. I mean, literally close to 1,000 metabolites have been measured using the combination of these different systems. So as Steve mentioned, the targeted metabolomics have leveraged the fact that there are now many studies, quite excellent, that suggest that both the elevation of branched-chain amino acids and the elevation of their catabolic products are somehow linked to increased insulin resistance and potentially a worse form of diabetes. And whenever you have a metabolomic result, which is either an absolute or a relative increase or decrease compared to some standard, you always have to ask yourself, how did it get there? I mean, is a metabolite increased because too much of it is being made or because not enough of it has been converted into something else? So is it a problem of conversion or is it a problem of synthesis? You can never tell that by looking at a pure metabolomic readout because that gives you a static measurement, a point in time measurement of concentration. People who made the observations regarding this elevation of branched chain amino acids being associated with insulin resistance have used a number of in vitro tests and animal models to try to show that, in fact, this increase has some inimical effects. To do this actually in human beings themselves is extraordinarily difficult. And the closest we get to is by using kinetic measurements. So kinetic measurements are typically done using isotopic infusions in people with different conditions. And then by looking at the way in which your label changes over time or its enrichment in a steady state, you can start to correlate what is the height of a branched amino acid metabolite? What is it telling you in terms of actual metabolic process? This has been done to a very limited extent because these studies are very difficult to do. But be that as it may, I think we can take it as fairly good, well-established, if not gospel, that elevations of branched-chain amino acids and their catabolites are probably a bad thing when it comes to diabetes control and insulin resistance. The clusters of lipid metabolites is a little more iffy. We will all accept that high triglycerides are a bad thing in diabetes. But then what the lipidomics suggest is that the length of the fatty acid carbon chain and the saturation of that chain and also the acylation of that chain may also affect its function and may also be a good or a bad thing. So just keep those two things in mind. Elevations of branched-chain amino acids and their catabolites, and on the lipid side, whether or not you have lots of triglycerides and diglycerides and whether or not you have long unsaturated chains, could that cluster mean something bad? Okay, so that's the background. So here are the findings. So it turns out that the increasing doses of tirzepatide, which is a dual agonist, were associated with much greater changes in metabolomics compared to baseline than the single dose of dulaglutide, and certainly much more than placebo. So the first point to make is that this dual agonist seemed to change a lot more things in the metabolites that were measured. And it seemed to change more and more as the dose went up. So in fact, all of the results I'm going to give you from here on in have to do with the highest dose of tirzepatide compared with placebo or tirzepatide compared with dulaglutide. So the first thing is that tirzepatide very effectively, and unlike the others, decreased the levels of all three branched-chain amino acids. That's leucine, isoleucine, and valine. And moreover, they also seem to sort of decrease the next step in the catabolism of these amino acids, which is the branched-chain keto acids. Now, they don't really demonstrate anything further down the line because ultimately these get oxidized. And the way to track them is through what's called acyl carnitines. They don't actually mention how those were different, but one could assume that if the first step was decreased, everything subsequently was decreased as well. So the entire panoply of things associated with branched-chain amino acids were decreased quite effectively with tirzepatide. And they happened to in a dose-dependent way. So the second question is, so what, right? Now, if you decrease these things, what effect did it have? Of course, this study cannot look at effects, but it can look at associations. And it turns out, based on their previous study, which looked at the clinical outcomes of this clinical trial, it turns out that these decreases in branched-chain amino acids and their metabolites are directly correlated quite significantly with changes in biochemical markers that we usually associate with either improved insulin sensitivity or improved insulin secretion, or at least the capacity of the beta cell to secrete more insulin. So it was directly correlated with changes in proinsulin levels, hemoglobin A1c, and HOMA2-IR. In other words, a measure of secretion, a measure of glycemic control, and at least a calculated measure of insulin sensitivity. So that was a good thing. But interestingly, there was no association between any of these BCAA changes and a change in weight. So that's actually kind of puzzling, right? Because one always thinks of these incretins as having two effects. One is on metabolism and the other is on weight. And we all know that you can't completely separate those two things. But it looked as though in this case, it is separable. It has all of these metabolic effects, but it didn't seem to have an effect on weight directly, right? And it only seemed to have an effect on weight through the metabolic effects and not by some independent effect, which is interesting. And the authors used something called ingenuity network analysis, which are these sort of established pathway analytical tools to see overall if your metabolic changes are linked to signaling pathways. And this is sort of an independent validation, if you like, of these associations that I just mentioned. And very nicely, the changes in BCAA metabolite concentrations seem to be very connected with pathways of insulin action, insulin signaling, and also proinsulin production and secretion. So it suggests that the connection between these changes in the metabolites and the changes that we see in metabolism and insulin secretion are probably not accidental. They probably are related in some mechanistic way to the extent that you can figure out looking at blood levels of things. Now, I think the same kind of analysis was done on the lipid classes. And all I can really say about that is that changes were seen in triglycerides, diglycerides, and also in the chain length and saturation of these triglycerides and diglycerides as an effect of tirzepatide, did not happen with placebo, did not happen with dulaglutide. Interestingly, there was no change with any drug on some other lipid markers that are thought to be bad for metabolism, such as ceramides or sphingomyelin. So the beneficial effect, if it's there, is restricted to the diglycerides and triglycerides. And again, there is a statistical association between these changes and insulin sensitivity. So again, this change appears to move in the right direction in regard to a clinical outcome. So I think I'll stop at that point because I've sort of summarized a lot of rather complex information, but I think that's the bottom line in terms of the results.
Good. Thank you, Ashok. And so now what we're going to do is take another step back and look at this in the discussion and try to understand a few different things. Again, we'll summarize this at a really high level because there's a lot of numbers. There are a lot of specific things that were looked at, but then also try to understand what's the impact of that. First of all, what's the mechanism? Why might this actually be happening? And then how should we be thinking about that? So what we're going to do is we'll start with the author's main conclusion. So just to give those to you again. So the authors conclude that with the highest dose of tirzepatide, it showed that 54 metabolites changed significantly after those 26 weeks of treatment, compared with only 6 with dulaglutide and then 0 for placebo. And then again, specifically, so tirzepatide had specific effects on three sets of metabolites, and those have all been shown to be associated with those dysmetabolic phenotypes in other studies. So again, one of those changes that were made is that it lowered the branched chain amino acids, the BCKA, other metabolites as well. Secondly, it markedly lowered the 2-HB, which is something that the authors point out has been strongly associated with glycemia. And then finally, as was mentioned already, it lowered several different things. So the triglycerides, the diglycerides, and had a fairly significant impact on that. So then what the authors do is try to make that connection. They pull in a bunch of other studies. They compare it to the medical literature as you're supposed to try to understand exactly what Steve started getting into already, which is, are these simply markers of something else that's going on? Is there actually a mechanism to where these changes in and of themselves are exerting this effect? So a few different things that they point out. So one, the authors mentioned that these branched chain amino acids and their catabolites are strongly associated with insulin resistance, with type 2 diabetes, and with cardiovascular disease. We maybe don't understand exactly why that is, but clearly are associated with it. They also point out that bariatric surgery causes a much more robust decrease in those BCAAs than dietary weight loss after matching for degree of weight loss. And then they also point out potentially a mechanistic link here is that lowering those branched chain amino acids and or their catabolites improves glucose and lipid metabolism within the tissues themselves. And so finally, they point out that whereas the GLP-1 receptor agonists improve insulin resistance primarily through weight loss, tirzepatide appears to have weight-independent effects, as was mentioned already. So then I think that leads to that final question, well, how does that actually do that? And again, this study wasn't designed to prove exactly how this happens, but the authors do attempt to give an explanation for how that might occur, and we'll look at that just in a second. But I thought here would actually be a good place to step out just a little bit and have Steve help us understand this, to put this in context. So these mechanisms, Steve, why are they so important? We're often looked at, as clinicians, we're used to looking at the real clinical outcomes, improvement on glucose lowering, improvements in complications, whether it's macrovascular, as we think about here, also a lot of microvascular ones. But why is it important in these studies and in this study in particular that we attempt to identify what these mechanisms are?
I think the crucial thing here is teasing out weight reduction and the benefits of weight reduction versus potential other incretin effects. And I was quite taken with the idea that bariatric surgery is having effects similar to what have been reported in this study, because I think most of us now would regard bariatric surgery as a major disruption of the incretin system rather than it being simply a physical act of altering the dynamics or size of the stomach. So ultimately, the aim of medicine therapies is to reproduce the bariatric surgery effect by using medications rather than surgery. And I think it's very intriguing that given that bariatric surgery is going to affect far more incretin effects rather than just GLP-1, the fact that disrupting GIP with tirzepatide might be part of that equation. So ultimately, it's a quest to find a medical therapeutic way of replicating the benefits of bariatric surgery without allowing our patients to see a bariatric surgeon.
Good. So that's helpful. So with that in mind, then what the authors suggest is that possibly it is, in fact, that change in the tissue itself, but it's possible that adipose tissue in particular is stimulated to uptake glucose and lipids. And maybe that's what's driving this beneficial effect that we're seeing. So we'll come back to that and think about what else we would need to understand and see to really understand the clinical impacts of a medication like this. But first of all, the authors point out, as they should, some limitations of their study. So they mention that these are stored samples that they had some impact in particular about how many of the subjects they could do the analysis on. They also point out that it is, in fact, a single fasting sample that is used for the analysis. And additionally, that there is only a single dose of the dulaglutide. So currently, there are multiple higher doses that are currently available. But at the time of this study, the 1.5 milligram weekly was the highest dose. And so that's why that was chosen. So hard to know how well that would compare to the higher doses that are currently available. And then finally, they point out, which is somewhat surprising for somebody like me to see, is that they actually say, you know what, we didn't really cover the metabolome very well, despite the fact that there were numerous labs that were measured here. This is an expanding field. There are lots of other things that could have been looked at that we weren't able to. And so maybe there are other aspects of the metabolome that we should have seen, should have looked at if we had been able to, that would have shed more light on what's going on here. So before we move on to the conclusion here, Steve and Ashok, any other thoughts that you would have on potential limitations of this study and anything that you would add to the list that the authors have provided here?
Well, I would say the main limitation, which is actually a really an important aspect for future research, is that one can't make any mechanistic conclusions from these data at all. And it's very interesting that the levels of these metabolites change with the drug, and it's also nice that they're associated with an improved clinical environment, but the real key is what is the mechanism by which it happens? And you can waste a lot of words and pages speculating, but it's quite pointless. On the other hand, I think one needs to use this information to be able to take the next step. I mean, could one, for instance, by infusing labeled branched-chain amino acids with and without this drug, be able to figure out what is the kinetic pathway by which this effect is seen? Because, you know, that would be extremely valuable. And, you know, we know in general that there is some evidence that changing branched-chain amino acids in experimental models can improve insulin sensitivity. One knows from clinical practice that by reducing triglycerides that you can, you know, improve not only cardiovascular health, but also insulin sensitivity. We know this in a broad way. But if this drug is actually doing something at a tissue-specific level to change that, either by oxidizing the fats at a greater rate or by disposing of the branched-chain amino acids or in some way opening up an alternative pathway that disposes of them, then we have a very interesting mechanistic connection. So I think these are all clues. I think this gives us some very nice clues to try to move on further. A limitation would be to speculate much more than the data at hand.
I fully agree with Ashok. I just say that this was an exploratory analysis. It was never going to prove or disprove anything. I think the limitations that the authors highlight are genuine. There was nothing they could really do about dulaglutide at the time, a maximum dose of 1.5 milligrams weekly. But I think it's very encouraging that they have seen differences between the agonist and the GLP-1 receptor agonist that begins to sort of give credibility to the fact that this molecule is behaving differently rather than it just facilitating higher doses of GLP-1 receptor. I think it's very encouraging that the candidate metabolites that they looked at were all shown to sort of work, go in the right direction. I also found it encouraging that there was a dose effect that was seen. It wasn't a sort of random, the 5 milligram works here, the 15 milligram works better there. So I think they're being quite honest about limitations, but it is what it is. And I think it's an encouraging paper to move on further analyses.
Good. And so before we get to that last bit, that of what would we need to see next, let me start with what the authors wrap up their paper with this claim at the end, in which they say, in addition to its superior actions to lower body weight and improve glycemic control, tirzepatide also has a unique effect to modify a set of metabolic factors previously shown to be associated with type 2 diabetes risk and metabolic dysregulation, in all cases changing the profile in a direction associated with improved metabolic health. So we've kind of heard a little bit already from Steve and Ashok kind of their sense of the quality of this report, that yes, it's exploratory, but at least adds a lot of information and helps us begin to understand what might be going on here. But where I'd like us to end with, and we'll start with you, is what do we think we would need to see? So there are these phase 3 trials will be ongoing. Those are the ones that we really look at to try to understand the impact of this drug and its benefits for our patients. So what do we need to be looking for when these studies come out to help us understand whether this would be a medication that would be beneficial to the patients that we provide care for?
Well, I have two thoughts, Chase, and they're both rather broad in scope, so I'll try to be brief. So one is, I think we're at a point in treating diabetes where we really want to cut through the heterogeneity of type 2 diabetes. We want at the diagnostic end to be able to classify people much better. And we want at the treatment end to be able to treat them in a much more targeted way. So already we're getting there, and some of the consensus arguments are in favor of targeting people with certain comorbidities, for instance, with drug X versus drug Y. That's a start, but it's still a pretty blunt instrument. What I really like to be able to do is to be able to say that, you know, if I think a critical aspect of your form of diabetes has to do with adiposity and weight, here are the better drugs to give you in addition to glycemic control. Whereas if the main issue really has to do with some kind of complex aspect of insulin resistance that is independent of weight, here's this other class of drug I might want to give you. I mean, that gets us a little closer to targeted treatment, though still a long way away. So I do think that looking out for trials will try to sift out phenotypic differences in patients in regard to these quite different drugs. As Steve pointed out, probably the GIPs act differently from GLPs, though synergistically. That'll be really helpful. So very broad hope, and one hopes they design the phase three trials to be able to answer this question. The other thing is that I love the fact that they tacked on something which was close to mechanistic and otherwise what was a classic RCT, right? The classic RCT gave you the outcomes. But this mechanistic work, even though I sounded a bit cynical, I think is actually incredibly important. Because without these clues, we have no way of knowing what the next target should be for guided treatment. I mean, look at metformin. It's, you know, been around for decades, and we used it with great effect for decades before even figuring out how it worked. And now we're slowly figuring out the three or four or five things it does, which might lead us to much more targeted treatment. So I think that piggybacking on metabolomics data offers tremendous clues, but it should be followed up with the next step, which I think would be mechanistic studies at the whole body or tissue level to see exactly how they're different. So I think that it opens up a lot of doors, and I'm actually extremely enthusiastic about this paper.
And I think that that gives some great examples to what Steve was talking about before of why we want to understand the underlying mechanisms in the first place, so that if we're going to tailor that care, we have to actually know what the drug is doing, so that when we identify why this person or another person has diabetes in the first place, then we can marry what's driving their disease with an agent that actually targets that factor in the first place. Good. So Steve, let's end with you then. So when we would look for future papers coming out on a medicine like this or other similar medications, what really are the outcomes that you will be looking for and that you might encourage us to be closely looking at in these phase three trials as they come out in the future?
Yeah, just to say, I love Ashok's comments about how this study could potentially go right the way back to diagnostic ability to subdivide patients into different groups that would then get appropriately targeted treatments. I think that's a great comment. The bottom line here, I'm afraid, and this affects companies developing new therapies like this, is a cardiovascular outcomes trial, because we may have lots of theoretical reasons why a dual agonist will be so much better, but the bottom line is that we won't know until we've actually done a trial. And I guess it's getting very difficult to do cardiovascular outcome trials versus placebo in the diabetes setting, because we've now got so many therapies that are known to have benefit. And then you're into the numbers game of how many people you need in a trial to prove non-inferiority versus one of the newer agents. I mean, just to take the pulse increase for GLP-1 receptor agonists, I know in some countries that delayed their introduction and licensing for a long time because the pulse rate increase was seen as a bad cardiovascular marker, and yet ultimately liraglutide, semaglutide, dulaglutide have all proven to be of benefit. So in terms of a dual agonist infiltrating that potential second line therapy, which is occupied by GLP-1 receptor agonists, I fear that they will definitely need to have a cardiovascular outcome trial of some sort to provide the evidence that will push the regulators and the payers and clinicians to prefer these agents.
And with that, I would like to thank Ashok Balasubramanian and Steve Bain for joining me for this month's edition of Endocrine Feedback Loop. I know you all learned a great deal and certainly did myself. Please join us again for next month's episode. And now you're in the loop. This has been Endocrine Feedback Loop. Endocrine Feedback Loop is brought to you as a members-only benefit of Endocrine Society with special production oversight by Maggie Graham.